Okay, hello. Majesty. I'll do without it. Well, welcome to the final session. I'm giving up on the microphone. It's too modern for me. Welcome to the final session of the day on record creation and creativity, or record creators and creativity. Our first speaker of the session is Dr. Arnold Hunt, who is the curator of historical manuscripts at the British Library. He's written a wonderful book on preaching, The Art of Hearing, but today he's moving from oral culture to written culture and talking about the early modern secretary. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, thank you to the organisers for inviting me to speak. My paper this afternoon is about the invisible technicians of the early modern archive. The concept of the invisible technician was famously introduced by Stephen Chapin with reference to the experimental scientists of late 17th century England, particularly Robert Boyle and Robert Hooke. As Chapin showed, Boyle and Hooke presented themselves as the makers and authors of scientific knowledge, yet they relied heavily on the labours of support staff, variously referred to as operators, laborators, assistants, workmen, or simply servants. These figures are largely invisible in the documentary record, and hence invisible to historians of science. In many cases, we don't even know their names. But as Chapin pointed out, their existence poses problems for the epistemology of early modern science. For where did it leave the authority of a Boyle or a Hooke if they depended on other people to build their instruments, carry out their experiments, and record the results? In short, science was a collective activity in which the gentleman philosopher claimed to speak for the skilled artisans and assistants under his control. In this, of course, it was not fundamentally different from the rest of early modern society, in which the master claimed to speak for the household servants and apprentices under his authority. Secretaries were in many respects very different from the anonymous workmen or assistants employed by Boyle or Hooke. They enjoyed a special relationship of trust and intimacy with their master, which allowed them to lay claim to a higher social status than that of a mere servant or apprentice. Angel Day began his treatise of the parts, place and office of a secretary by observing that the secretary had a double relationship with his master, being in one condition a servant and being in a second respect as a friend, an ambiguity beautifully portrayed in Van Dyck's portrait of Thomas Wentworth, Earl of Strafford, with his secretary, Sir Philip Mannering. So wouldn't you like him as your boss? But secretaries too are curiously invisible figures. Sir Francis Walsingham's secretary, Nicholas Faunt, wrote that the secretary should serve his master as his own pen, his mouth, his eye, his ear, and keeper of his most secret cabinet. So perhaps it's not surprising that the secretary rarely emerges from his master's shadow. Faunt's reference to the secretary as the keeper of his master's cabinet is a reminder that the secretary's technical expertise was deployed preeminently in the creation and handling of written records. Yet even here, in the secretary's special domain, it is often hard to reconstruct the secretary's role in making and shaping the early modern archive. My aim in this paper is therefore to bring the early modern secretary out of the shadows. I will begin by looking briefly at the history and meaning of the term secretary and its emergence as a profession in the late medieval and early modern periods. But in keeping with the theme of this conference, I want to look in particular detail at the secretary's role as record keeper, what in modern parlance we might call the back office function, which in the early modern period was perceived as an integral part of the secretary's duties. As Angel Day argued, the secretary was not merely a scribe, not merely a writer of letters, but had a far more important role, expressed in the very etymology of the word itself, as a keeper of secrets. And he went on to draw a revealing analogy between the moral integrity of the secretary and physical integrity of the secrets preserved in the archive. Unto every secret there is required a closet. To a closet there belongeth properly a door, a lock, and a key. To a secretary there appertaineth honesty, care, and fidelity. And I shall pursue this analogy in the second half of my paper by looking at some of the material traces left by secretaries on the written documents under their care, and what these might tell us about the physical organisation of early modern archives. The term secretary first appears in English in the late 14th century as a translation of the Latin secretarius, meaning someone entrusted with private or confidential matters. The period which sees the emergence of the term secretary is also the period which sees the first systematic preservation of private archives, and these two developments may not be unconnected. A particularly significant figure in this regard is William Worcester, who was secretarius, secretary to Sir John Fastolf in the 1440s and 1450s. R.B. Macfarlane, who hailed Worcester as the first Englishman to deserve the name of antiquary, pointed out that the group of people with whom he lived was, as far as we know, the first to keep its private correspondence on a scale which neither untidiness nor accident can explain. It may therefore be to Worcester's record-keeping instincts that we owe the survival of the Paston letters. Another related development in the 15th century, of course, was the rise of the principal secretary as the keeper of the king's signet and the overseer of his private correspondence. By the later 16th century, the role of secretary had become established as a popular career path for young university graduates. William Stafford, writing in 1581, even went so far as to complain that the universities be in manner emptied because so many young men were dropping out of college in order to take up posts as private secretaries in noble or gentry households. Nowadays, he wrote, men send their sons to university merely to have a little of the Latin tongue, and then they will take them away and bestow them to be a secretary with some great man or other. And there were several well-known success stories of secretaries rising to high office in their own right. Dudley Carleton got his start as secretary to Sir Henry Neville and went on to succeed his master as English ambassador in Paris. Isaac Wake, in turn, got his start as secretary to Dudley Carleton and also went on to a distinguished diplomatic career. Edward Peyton, writing in 1633, commented that there can be nothing more honourable to the master than to breed up his servant in such abilities as he may afterwards do service to our monarchy, adding, in a striking turn of phrase, that in this way the servant's reputation is brick-walled to his master's honour. Not everyone, of course, was quite so lucky. Peter Morton, the son of a minor Cheshire gentry family, served as secretary to Sir Isaac Wake in Turin and might have expected to follow the footsteps of Neville, Carleton and Wake into high diplomatic office. But Wake's unexpected death in 1632 left him high and dry, unemployed and without a patron. Morton attempted to get a new post as secretary to the Duke of Lennox, but warned his father that the post would be highly sought after. I know of some who are at present in pursuit of it, and spent the next 6 months as a hanger-on at court, trying and failing to persuade the Earl of Portland to put in a good word for him. Secretaries could be well rewarded, but as Morton's example demonstrates, their reliance on elite patronage also made them highly insecure. This insecurity is very apparent in the advice literature for secretaries that started to appear in the late 16th century. I've already mentioned Day's treatise of the parts, place and office of a secretary, which seeks to position the secretary as a gentleman, a man choice and of worthy estimate, ability and judgment, and not a mere pen pusher. Stefano Guazzo's treatise on civil conversation, first published in Italian in 1574 and translated into English by George Petty in 1581, draws an interesting contrast between the social position of secretaries in Italy and France. In Italy, Guazzo notes approvingly, the secretaries of princes are had in great honour and justly, for that they are partakers of their inward thoughts and the keepers, as it were, upon trust of their honour and estimation. In France, on the other hand, he that hath a servant which can copy out writings and keep count of his revenues in a book, he giveth him forthwith the name of secretary. Guazzo goes on to relate how, when he travelled to noble houses in France in the service of his master, Gonzaga, he was soon let in if he termed himself one of the Duke's gentlemen, but if he named himself secretary, they made him tarry longer and regarded him the lesser. And he sums this up with an anecdote from first-hand experience, which suggests troublingly that even a groom could now be classed as a secretary merely by virtue of possessing basic literacy skills. And you can see it on the screen. They're being to change horses, he says. The postmaster came to him and called twice aloud, secretary! And forthwith there came out of the stable a foul great groom with a pen and inkhorn at his girdle, a pen at his ear, who had charge given him to make ready the horses. And Guazzo goes on, he asked why his master made the secretary dress horse, who answered, but his master took him for a groom of the stable. But for that he could write and keep a reckoning of the horses which were let out, his master had likewise made him his secretary. So you can almost hear Guazzo's voice quivering with indignation there. I think it's important to keep this in mind, I think, because it's a kind of corrective to the idealised view of the secretary that you find in the advice literature by Angel Day and others, which presents the secretary as this figure, as this intimate figure, the friend at the elbow of his master. Of course, that was how secretaries wanted to see themselves. But the role of the secretary was always in danger of collapsing downwards into that of the scrivener or the copyist. Secretaries face an uphill struggle to establish themselves as a professional elite. Over the last 20 years, there's been a steadily growing body of scholarship on the person and function of the secretary. It's greatly enhanced our understanding of early modern record making and record keeping. And Stewart and Richard Vambus have explored the secretary's role as a keeper of secrets, the intimacy of the relationship between secretaries and their masters, and the homoerotic anxieties that swirl around it. And there have been several case studies of particular statesmen and their secretariats, perhaps most significantly Paul Hammer on the secretariat of the Second Earl of Essex, showing that Essex made use of his secretaries as a kind of personal think tank and policy unit. And more recently, Christopher Berlinson and Andrew Zirka have encouraged us to look at the master-secretary relationship from the secretary's point of view by giving us an edition of the letters copied by Edmund Spenser as secretary to Lord Grey of Wilton. In this brief paper, it's impossible to offer more than a cursory overview of the secondary literature, but I'd like to draw out a couple of points which I think are particularly relevant to the theme of this conference. The main point is that the intimacy of the master-secretary relationship often makes it hard to disentangle the two or determine the authorship of any given document, whatever authorship may mean in this context. It was widely assumed that the secretary would merge his own individuality with that of his master, even to the point of imitating his master's handwriting, invisible technicians again. There's a good example of this in the letters of Isaac Wake to William Trumbull in 1624, just after Wake had taken on a new secretary, John Wilkinson. In a letter of June 1624, Wake apologised to Trumbull for Wilkinson's poor handwriting. He comments, "I have a young whelp for my secretary who will learn hereafter to write better." And as you turn the pages of the letters in the correspondence, over the next 6 months, you can watch the process, the learning process gradually taking place. You can see Wilkinson's handwriting gradually evolving and changing into a more fluent running hand, which closely resembles Wake's own handwriting. So you can see the secretary gradually conforming himself to the image of his master. By the same token, it's often hard to be sure how far the secretary may have been involved in the composition as well as the copying of documents. Edward Paynton described his secretary's role as being to write with an alluring, stately and grave style when his master dictates to him, putting it into a good phrase, language and happy method, implying that the secretary played a major part in reshaping and improving the dictated draft. But most of this process is hidden from our view. Take, for example, the letters of Elizabeth I to James VI. The most personal of these are written in the Queen's own hand, in what she called her scribbling hand, her informal hand, rather than her more formal italic script. And it's natural to assume that they represent her own unaided work. Perhaps they do. That would be in accordance with the advice of Erasmus, who famously recommended princes to write letters in their own handwriting as a guarantee of authorship, because, I quote, Erasmus says, secretaries often make their own changes. On the other hand, some of Elizabeth's less private letters to James were certainly drafted for her, as shown by the survival of one draft in the Cotton Papers, where the letter is written in a secretarial hand with corrections added by Burley. We know very little about the process of drafting that may have preceded the final holograph copy, but it is at least possible that Elizabeth's letters to James are the result of a more collaborative process than has generally been realised. Now, I now wish to move on and in the second part of my paper look at the secretary's role as a record keeper. Alan Stewart has put an elegant spin on the topos of the king's two bodies by suggesting that the secretary too has two bodies, the body personal and the body archival. It's that archival body that I want to explore now, and as it were, read backwards from the archive to the secretarial practices that created them. It's not an easy task, because the early modern archives that have come down to us have very often been rearranged over the centuries, and now bear very little resemblance to their original shape or form. We do, however, have several contemporary guides to secretarial practice, of which the two best known are Robert Beale's Instructions for Principal Secretary and Nicholas Font's Discourse Touching the Office of Principal Secretary of Estate, both drawing on the experience of working in Walsingham's private office. So what can these tell us about the technologies of early modern record keeping? According to Font, the principal secretary needs two servants, or as we might say, under-secretaries, the first of whom is entrusted with secret matters, and the second with the dispatch of ordinary matters. And the task of the second under-secretary is to be continually present in the chamber where the papers are, endorsing them as they daily come in, and dividing them into three main categories: home letters, which are the greatest multitude, council matters, concerning any private or public cause, and diverse matters, which contain petitions to the secretary, discourses, projects, relations, declarations, or informations of private or public causes. He arranges them into bundles every morning as they come in, and then, when they've been dealt with, he clears them off the table and moves them into some chest or place, lest confusion or loss of some of them grow through an exceeding and unnecessary multitude of papers, as hath been seen in that place. Font gives us an admirably clear and concise summary of the methods used for the receipt and archiving of incoming papers. One of his chief concerns, as you can see here, is the problem of information overload if letters are allowed to pile up on the table instead of being dealt with promptly when they come in. And the reference to an exceeding and unnecessary multitude of papers, as hath been seen in that place, suggests that this is exactly what happened in Walsingham's private office. The papers had got out of control for want of proper archiving. And the solution that Font recommends for this is to keep a set of reference books, including a journal recording the date of all incoming and outgoing correspondence, and a memorial book for any matters that require immediate action. Once these have been established as an index or digest of the records, then the original papers can be filed away. And Beale recommends a similar procedure for the archiving of the loose papers in the Privy Council records. The loose papers are to be tied up in a bundle at the end of every month, and the clerk, he goes on, is to keep a record of the contents of every bundle in the form of a calendar, so as by the said calendar he may know in what month and bundle to find that which shall be asked for, if any of the papers need to be referred to again. And we have another account of the record-keeping practices in the Principal Secretary's office, this one in a letter from Humphrey Fulwood to Sir John Cook in 1628. Cook's secretary, Gilbert Thacker, had just died unexpectedly, and Fulwood, who had been his deputy, was hoping to succeed him. So to show how well qualified he was for the post, Fulwood gives a description of all the main duties of the Under-Secretary, from which I've chosen the extracts that refer to record-keeping. First, he says, there's the copying from your honour's hand, writing as you shall dictate. So there's fair copying of written papers, but also copying from dictation. Writing out fair and entering into a book of all ordinary letters and dispatches to ambassadors, as also orderly to keep all such letters and other things, so as upon the sudden they being called for, they may be forthwith found. And further on, he goes on, he mentions the keeping of all such writings as concern the several states abroad with whom we have correspondence, as also all writing as domestic, and so on, and each of them to keep by themselves apart, ready to be produced upon demand. This suggests that the organisation of the records has not changed significantly since Beale and Font and Font's time. Again, there's the division of incoming correspondence into a few main categories: foreign letters, home letters, council matters, so forth. And again, there is the clear impression of a working archive, from which papers may need to be retrieved, each of them to keep by themselves apart, ready to be produced upon demand. What traces did this archival process leave on the written documents themselves? Beale tells us that when papers were to be passed around the council table, it was customary to summarise their contents in a note on the back or on a separate sheet. It hath been the manner, he says, that the secretary should abbreviate on the back side of the letters, or otherwise in a by-paper, the substantial and most material points which are to be propounded and answered. The image here shows a note in Beale's hand on the back of a document now in the Elverton papers in the BL. The document relates to a treaty between the Pope the King of Spain and the Duke of Florence. And you can see there, Beale has added a note to himself, apparently to remind himself where the paper ought to be filed. Confer this with the intended invasion by the Spanish Navy. In other words, put this in the file with the other papers on the Spanish Armada. Many of the documents in the Yelverton papers carry notes by Beale written, just as he says here, on the back side of the letters. In some cases, these notes give a précis, as he says, of the substantial and most material points. But in most cases, they've clearly been added for record-keeping purposes. They are there to ensure that the document can be easily filed and easily retrieved. Anyone who's worked on early modern records will be familiar with these endorsements, which can be found on thousands of documents in many different archives. Here are three typical examples from the papers of, respectively, Sir Julius Caesar, Anthony Bacon, and Sir John Cook. In each case, the letter has been refolded after receipt, often folding across the original address panel. And the endorsement is written at the top, so the secretary could read it easily as he ran his thumb down a bundle of letters. The most prominent piece of information is generally the date, which shows that the letters must originally have been filed together in chronological order. In many cases, the endorsement consists simply of the date and the name of the writer, which suggests that the contents of the letter must have been summarised elsewhere in a separate journal or minute book. This is in accordance with the advice given by Font, who warns against summarising the contents on the original original paper or letter as it was sent, as this, he says, can be easily mislaid or forgotten. What is remarkable about these examples is how similar they all are. They suggest a high degree of uniformity in early modern record-keeping practices. So to finish, I want to highlight a couple of examples where the endorsement on the letter may have a more complex story to tell us about the history of an archive. My first example comes from papers of William Cecil, Lord Burghley. Burghley's papers are now widely scattered across several different collections, including the Cecil papers at Hatfield House and the Lansdowne and Cotton manuscripts in the British Library. The Cotton State Papers were a particularly confusing collection, having been assembled from a number of different sources. They include documents originally belonging to Burghley, to Leicester, to Walsingham, often mixed up within a single volume. The original arrangement of Burghley's papers is therefore all but impossible to reconstruct, although we may get a clue from some notes that he scribbled on the back of a letter in 1565. On the left-hand side is an endorsement by one of his secretaries, 11th September 1565, Earl of Bedford to my master. But on the right-hand side are some notes in Burghley's own unmistakable hand listing the main categories of his incoming correspondence. Letters to the Queen, to the Queen's Majesty generally, subdivided by France, Spain, Scotland and Germany. Letters to the Council, letters to myself, divided into public causes and private suits. Then a heavily corrected list of requests or complaints, again subdivided into private suits to the Queen's Majesty, for strangers born, for causes of the wards, and examinations of matters. It's possible that what we have here is Burghley's own plan for the arrangement of his papers, an arrangement now thoroughly obscured by four centuries of archival reorganisation. Most of Burghley's papers bear an endorsement of the type shown here, clearly by one of his secretaries, as it refers to my master or my lord. A small minority, however, are endorsed by Burghley himself, as in the example shown here from one of the volumes of the Cotton State Papers. 25th April, Mr. Thomas Randolph from Edinburgh. Why did Burghley endorse these letters himself instead of passing them over to his secretary? Burghley was well known for keeping a very small secretariat. Burden not yourself with too many clerks or servants, Beale was later to write. The Lord Treasurer Burghley, being secretary, had but two or three. So it's possible that this is simply an example of Burghley's stubbornly conservative habit of filing his own paperwork. But there is another possible explanation. It may be that the documents personally endorsed by Burghley come from a private cabinet that he kept under his own personal control, separate from the main body of his archive. And if so, these endorsements may give us another insight into the original arrangement of his papers. My second example comes from a letter of 1613 in the State Papers Forum in the National Archives at Kew. The period 1613 to 15 saw an upheaval in the administration of Jacobean foreign policy as the royal favourite, Robert Carr, Earl of Somerset, attempted to divert the flow of incoming foreign correspondence towards himself. In July 1614, the news writer Thomas Larkin reported that Somerset continues to receive all the packets to order the dispatches and in a manner disburdens the secretary Sir Ralph Winwood, of the whole care of foreign affairs. English diplomats abroad quickly became aware of Somerset's hijacking of the bureaucratic machinery. In July 1613, Sir Dudley Carleton wrote to Somerset that since my dispatches to His Majesty to pass through your Lordship's hands, he'd spared himself the trouble of making a second copy to send to Somerset personally. What impact might this have had on the filing of foreign correspondence? We don't know for certain, but we can get a clue from the endorsement on this letter, where Somerset has written, Sir Dudley Carleton to His Majesty, and then corrected himself, Sir Dudley Carleton to myself. This strongly suggests the archiving of incoming letters was under Somerset's direct control. It also suggests that the official dispatches were being filed in very close proximity to Somerset's own private papers, perhaps even in the same bundle. So here in microcosm, in that tiny endorsement on the back of a letter, we can see opening up the whole arrangements upheaval in Jacobean foreign policy caused by Somerset's eruption into the running of the Secretary of State's office. In conclusion, I'd like to circle back to the idea of the invisible technician and reflect on what's probably the most celebrated historical study of a secretary, Geoffrey Elton's study of Thomas Cromwell in the Tudor Revolutionary Government. Elton attached particular importance to Cromwell's creation of a private office where his correspondence was written and received, endorsed, classified, and filed away. But at the heart of this bureaucratic revolution was a bureaucratic void. Elton had to admit that the workings of the private office are, as he put it, not likely ever to emerge from obscurity. Invisible technicians again. And what could be rescued from obscurity did not exactly fit the picture of a well-oiled bureaucratic machine. Everything appears far too fluid, Elton complained, with different people doing the same or different business without any distinct division of labour. It now appears that the reason Elton was unable to find a tightly organised bureaucracy was that there was no tightly organised bureaucracy there to find. Alan Smith's verdict on the Cecil as a mere secretariat is equally applicable to Cromwell and his. The very essence of the Cecil secretariat, Smith writes, was that they were not bureaucratic machines. The secretaries were appointed and dismissed entirely at the discretion of the two Cecils, who determined, as they thought fit, the number of secretaries and the organisation of their work. The history of the early modern secretary is thus ultimately not a history of bureaucracy. It's a history of the personal relationship between the master and the secretary. That personal relationship has to be at the centre of our inquiry, and that, I suggest, is why the best method of understanding early modern record keeping is to look at the record keepers themselves. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Arnold. So our next speaker is Dr. Adam Smythe of Oxford University and Balliol College. He's a lecturer in the history of the book. He's written widely on autobiography and record keeping and the connections between the two. And we'll speak now on record keeping and literary creativity in early modern England. Thank you.
Thank you very much. One of the experiences of being the final speaker of the day is of hearing your lovingly assembled points and examples appear and reappear in other papers throughout the day, an experience which is both reassuring and alarming at the same time. But no one has discussed Cymbeline, as far as I remember, and I'll get on to that in a moment. I'd like to talk today about literary creativity and record keeping. If this was a conference in the 1990s, I might have titled my paper, The Literature of Record Keeping and the Record Keeping of Literature. But while the moment of the conference paper chiasmus may have passed, I'd like still to suggest that we can get somewhere by collapsing or entangling these two terms, which perhaps at first seem to be opposed. If there's a single question running through what I say today, running through or perhaps hovering slightly above, it's the question of why we read certain kinds of text in certain kinds of ways. Why we respond to a sonnet, for example, with a different set of interpretive protocols to a list of household accounts. What happens if, for a moment, we invert those assumptions? If we approach a sonnet as if it were a list of domestic expenses, or a list of household expenses as if it were a poem about love? We read certain kinds of writing in certain kinds of ways, in part because we're dutiful, and we read in the ways early modern books tell us to read. And this may not be a good thing. The most influential representation of literary creativity is in English comes in the first folio of 1623, of course, when editors Heming and Condell describe their deceased friend Shakespeare as a happy imitator of nature, whose mind and hand went together, and who uttered with that easiness that we have scarce received from him a blot in his papers. Ben Jonson's reply was, "Would he had blotted a thousand." But Shakespeare, in the first folio's paradigmatic description of authorship, is uncluttered. Uncluttered by notebooks, drafts, scraps of paper, pretty much anything that would interest us today at a conference about record keeping. According to Heming and Condell, this lack of an archive of drafts and first attempts and abandoned prologues is a measure of Shakespeare's accomplishment, and a reason why we should respond and re-respond to him with particular diligence. Read him, therefore, they prescribe, and again and again. But this influential story of dematerialized creativity is, of course, a fiction. Everything we know about early modern writing suggests it was all about blots. Blots and notes and, crucially, the shunting of text from notebook to notebook, a process of finding and redrafting rather than creating ex nihilo. A mode that characterized not only financial record keeping, where records moved, as we've been hearing, from waste book to journal to ledger, being rewritten as they moved around, but also autobiographical writing, and I think what we would now call literature. And if we lack the commonplace books I'm sure did lie beneath Shakespeare's creativity, we know for certain that Shakespeare thought about record keeping, because he writes about it in his plays and in his poetry. We could choose from a number of scenes, but Act 2, Scene 2 of Cymbeline is a particularly suggestive example. Shakespeare was fond of placing one genre of writing within another, a sonnet inside a comedy, for example. And here he embeds record keeping in what the first folio calls a tragedy. And I think that's an interesting question that I've not yet fully got my head around, how record keeping functions differently when it operates inside another genre. To win a bet, Giacomo needs evidence that he's slept with Inogen, even though he hasn't. How does he try to prove this? As Inogen falls asleep reading about Tereus and Philomel, Giacomo climbs from a trunk and compiles an inventory of the room. "To note the chamber," he says, "I will write all down." And there's a deeply unsettling convergence in this scene between constructing an inventory of Inogen's room, the male gaze as an aggressive form of possessing, and the threat of rape. So Giacomo proceeds, offering the kind of piece-by-piece itemization of a room we find in a household inventory, but here embedded in a play, before switching, because his need for proof increases and increases, to an inventorying of Inogen's body. So this is how he begins, at number two on your handout, noting down his records, accumulating evidence of his familiarity with the room, all of this in pursuit of proof of his fictional intimacy with Inogen. And the first folio text, characteristically, doesn't give us stage directions, but modern editors suggest Giacomo writes or takes out his notebook or writes in his tables. "Such and such pictures," he says. "There the window, such the adornment of her bed, the arras, figures, why, such and such, and the contents of the story. Ah, but some natural notes about her body, above 10,000 meaner movables, would testify to enrich my inventory." And then he takes off her bracelet, and then he shifts from noting the room to noting Inogen. "On her left breast, a mole sank spotted, like the crimson drops at the bottom of a cowslip. Here's a voucher, stronger than ever law could make. This secret will force him think I have picked the lock and taken the treasure of her honour." And then he stops, no more, aware suddenly of the obsolescence of record keeping in the face of Inogen's unforgettable beauty. "Why should I write this down that's riveted, screwed to my memory?" So what does this little scene tell us about record keeping? Well, I think maybe a couple of things. First, the inventory here is a form associated with a kind of particularized truthfulness. Giacomo wants evidence of an affair with Inogen, and the inventory suits his needs. More particulars, he says, understanding the form, as Shakespearean villains intuitively understand rhetorical forms, must justify my knowledge. He's banking on his rival, Posthumus, believing his account. But the relationship between inventory and truth is immediately troubled as soon as it's set up, partly because Giacomo's record-keeping is compiled to prove something that never happened. It's a truthful inventory to substantiate a fiction. If we read this scene as the First Folio tells us to, and again, Giacomo's use of the term inventory becomes more and more complicated. His inventory is a list of things, but it's also a literary process of inventio, the gathering of pieces to form a rhetorical composition, and it's also an invention, a plot or design, something made up. The relationship between inventory and truth is also troubled because Giacomo is aware, as he looks for evidence of his intimacy with Inogen, that there may be other, better ways of confirming his presence in her bedroom. The inventory emerges as one device among several for corroborating an account, and Giacomo clutches at three layers of proof. He starts with a written inventory of the room's contents, then he seizes an object, a bracelet, that will witness outwardly better an object than a record of an object. And then he turns, finally, to the beauty of Inogen herself. Even better proof, a voucher, he says, stronger than ever law could make, and his clipped rhetoric suddenly expands like the crimson drops at the bottom of a cowslip. The question becomes not whether the inventory is true or false, but rather how rhetorically effective it is, how well it will, in Giacomo's words, induce you to believe in comparison with other ways of proving a story. So that's the first implication, perhaps, a link between the inventory and truth that grows more fraught the closer we look. A second implication. Giacomo's note-taking is only the first stage in a process of rewriting and amplifying his record of Inogen's bedchamber. The brief notes that are at first airily imprecise, such and such pictures, are two scenes later, and in retrospect, filled out into vivid, moralized narrative, the kind of thing you can see at number three on the handout. There the window, such the adornment of her bed, in Act 2, Scene 2, becomes two scenes later as he recounts his inventory to his rival, becomes, it was hanged with tapestry of silk and silver, the story proud Cleopatra when she met her Roman, a piece of work so bravely done, so rich that it did strive in workmanship and value, and so on. The inventory then becomes an initial text that enables a process of transmission and revision. We might take this as evidence of Giacomo's deception, but that would probably be anachronistic. We see this mode of writing everywhere, this sense of non-narrative record-keeping preceding and enabling fuller narrative. Or to put it another way, of the production of narrative as a filling out of earlier records. Samuel Pepys gives us one example. It's tempting to describe Pepys's life writing in terms of immediacy and candor, a kind of hasty pouring out. But we get a very different sense in those entries in 1668, where Pepys offers not narrative prose, but a series of financial records. And you have this at number four on your handout. At Barnet for milk, sixpence. On the highway to Menders of the highway, sixpence. Dinner at Stevenage, 5 shillings, sixpence. Father's servants, father having in the garden, told me bad stories of my wife's ill words. 14 shillings. One that helped at the horses, 1 shilling. Menders of the highway, 2 shillings. Pleasant country to Bedford, where while there stay, I rode through the town, in a good country town, and there drinking we on to Newport, and there light, and I, and WH to the church, and there give the boy 1 shilling. So Pepys's diary writing began with a noting down of laconic staccato financial notes, which were then revised into narrative. But here, for some reason, whatever reason it was, he didn't get round to revising, and the earlier records, normally effaced beneath the narrative diary, are still visible. And the presence of these generally hidden layers of accounts has a number of implications. Most obviously, that financial accounting was an early, now largely erased stage in the production of Pepys's diary. In fact, I'm sure there was a broader, more complicated process of textual traffic beneath the smooth surface of Pepys's text, involving many kinds of text and notebooks, but financial accounts are central. And more broadly, the popular perception of Pepys as someone who, in his diary, offers unmediated plunges at life looks untenable. Or rather, Pepys's famously impulsive prose was the product of distinct and careful stages of revision, and Pepys's diary represents not spontaneity, but the artful construction of spontaneity. And read in this context, Pepys and Shakespeare's Giacomo, with his brief inventory later filled out, look less like a post-romantic scribbler compelled to a kind of urgent candour, and more like someone at home in Jan Gussart's portrait, familiar to us now, already at number 5 on the handout, which captures brilliantly the author as administrator, as reviser of records, and which depicts writing as the noisy clatter of texts in motion. I think this image is kind of becoming a sort of an image for the early modern period in the way the cover of Greenblatt's Renaissance self-fashioning for a while, the ambassador stood for the period. This seems to be having its moment, this particular image here. Giacomo's inventory is an attempt to substantiate his claims of an affair. Figure 6 shows a financial account with a different aim. It's the record composed by 24-year-old Edward Deering for the funeral of his young wife, Elizabeth. And I'll read a little bit out from this financial account. Given postboy, sixpence. Hire of a hackney for Nicholas to Maidstone, 2 shillings 6 pence. Given the poor of Pluckley, £1. Given Mr. Bennett, the physician, £1, 2 shillings. Given Mr. Dr. Mosley for his funeral sermon, £3. Given Lydia, 10 shillings. Given the poor at Surrenden House, given Mrs. Bennett. Given the sexton for tolling the bell and digging the grave, 10 shillings. Paid Thomas Robbins for lending of black cotton to hang all the church, except the greater chancel, 3 times down the body and my father's hall, 7 and 6. 3 black liveries and a pulpit cloth, which Mr. Copley had to make a cloak of, £6, 3 shillings and 4 pence. For the hire of a velvet hearse cloth, £1. A black cloak for myself at 35 shillings per yard, £4, 11 and 10. 2 pairs of gloves, garters and ribbons, a hat and band. Now, there are lots of things I think we could do with this text if we're interested, say, in the microhistory of Kent in 1622, or poor relief, or the culturally legible ways of articulating grief. But what I'd like to stress is the literariness of this financial account. If Cymbeline is a play that thinks about record-keeping, then Deering's financial account is a rhetorical performance that, like Giacomo's bedchamber inventory, seeks to convince us of its probity. This is a text that wants to be believed. Which isn't to say it's untrue, although it might be, conceivably, but rather that the effect of truthfulness is produced through a series of literary manoeuvres. And let me briefly point out a couple of these. One of the things that unites these two texts, Cymbeline and Deering's account of the funeral, may be a kind of queasiness we feel about their form, or rather about the collision of form and occasion. There's perhaps something unsettling, inappropriate, petty, maybe, about a description of a funeral in an account book. Rather as, in Cymbeline, Giacomo uses the inventory as a kind of matrix to place over a darkly erotic scene. What we have in Deering's account is not a coherent narrative, but a list of discrete transactions. The impression is of an event, which we might expect to possess a kind of tragic coherence, crumbled into pieces. And that form perhaps jars with how we expect a funeral to be conveyed. And yet in some ways the account does strain to lend coherence to these individual transactions. You can see the addition of brackets to the left of the financial accounts, enclosing the particular funeral day expenses, and there are lots of expenses either side which aren't bracketed in that way. And so the structure of the book tends to resist the creation of coherent events, but Deering's brackets tug the account towards coherence. Is there any prioritizing of transactions? Well, at first glance, there's a startling juxtaposition, the apparently trivial and the significant. Tolling the bell and digging the grave is given equal space with a hat and band. So there's a kind of anti-narrative leveling. But each record is given a financial value. And this precisely calibrated system of value means a clear hierarchy of significance does emerge. The effect is of a reading and an interpretation. By the criteria of the account book, the most significant record is 3 black liveries and a pulpit cloth, which Mr. Copley had to make a cloak of. So out of the apparently indiscriminate list of financial transactions, a system of evaluation emerges. Now, this application of an exact financial value to each record is interesting for at least two reasons, I think. First, because it means that a text that is involved with, it means that this is a text that is involved with metaphor, that changes one thing, like Lydia, into another, 10 shillings. And second, this results in the conversion of different kinds of records to a single scale. Everything is put in the same currency. And the effect of this is to enable exact quantifiable relationships to be established between records that might normally seem incomparable. Thus, for example, by the logic of the account book, the charity displayed towards the poor at Pluckley, £1, is twice as significant as the sexton for tolling the bell and digging the grave, 10 shillings. And the implication of this culture of equivalency is there in Cymbeline. It's why we flinch at the description of Imogen's body as an item in an inventory, after the widow, the window, the bed, the arras. And this culture where everything can be converted into financial value and so becomes fungible, can always be swapped with something else, haunts much of the drama of the period, in King Lear most famously, where the old king draws on a correspondence between love and land. So the account book converts all events into comparable financial value, but we can also see Deering resisting this system of evaluation by breaking away occasionally from accounting norms to convey other assessments of worth. And I'll mention just two brief examples of the ways in which he breaks away from generic expectations. First, he adds titles for sections of his accounts to offer an interpretation of the time covered. The last quarter of 1618 he labels my prodigal year. And after Michaelmas 1619, when he gets married, he writes my desperate courser. And second, at times he suddenly provides, in some records, a level of description that exceeds the requirements of the account book. He writes, paid my cousin Dering sixpence, which he gave away. And those final four words, which he gave away, aren't necessary for the account book, and so suggest some significance, disapproval, presumably, from Dering. Another, given my wife this quarter, £1, 3 shillings and eightpence, besides her allowance, which she lost at cards. And this level of detail, besides her allowance, which she lost at cards, represents another moment when Dering invests his record with a response that is beyond the purely financial, beyond what we might expect. And so if we read these financial records with a sense of genre, and in particular an awareness of when Dering's text exceeds what is required of it, we can do a bit more than just read the account book for facts. So I have two very brief final implications, which are contradictory, I realise. First, that we should read records with a sensitivity to genre and appreciate, as everyone here knows, that an inventory is not a collection of objects, but a literary genre. And as a literary genre, it has debts not only to the things it describes, but also to the rhetorical conventions it's required to perform in order to qualify as an inventory. The text is looking in different directions at the same time. The sentimental fantasy of the inventory is that we can enter the past, can occupy the room, see the things, but there is a gap between object and record. And Cymbeline treads around this dream. When Giacomo describes Imogen's bedchamber, he says, never saw I figures so likely to report themselves. Objects that talk are self-inventorying objects. They tell us what they are, even as they are that thing, and they close the gap between inventory and object. But even in Giacomo's fantasy, Imogen's vivid bedchamber possessions don't quite speak. They almost speak, but they don't. The difference between a collection of objects and a list of those objects is slight but crucial, and reading with a sensitivity to genre keeps them apart. My second implication is that we should not read with a sensitivity to genre, or rather that we're too credulous and too passive if we only read with the protocols and expectations that the text asked us to deploy. Shakespearean criticism has been good at doubting professed genres and about considering what happens if we read Cymbeline not as the tragedy that the first folio tells us to expect, but as a romance or a problem play. What would happen if to a financial record of a funeral, say, if we read it as a form of elegy? Or if we read the inventory of wedding gifts as a sonnet? Well, we might think about that Petrarchan dynamic of possession and dispossession, or about the presence of metaphor turning one thing into another, or about Blaison, the poetic device of describing or itemizing a person part by part, her eyes, her lips, her hair, etc. Or about the fragility of the narrator's voice or the ironies between form and content or any number of things. So perhaps instead of reading, perhaps instead of reading that is genre sensitive, we could try insensitive reading, a reading of text that deploys inappropriate genres, which is, I think, related to, but not quite the same as reading against the grain. I think the financial records, and I think everything we've heard today supports this, financial records and household accounts have great riches in them that sometimes a literal or non-speculative reading can perhaps overlook. And reading these records for a moment as different kinds of text can help release those riches. Thank you.
Stimulating papers. We have perhaps 10 minutes for questions, if there are questions. Yes, Mary.
A question for Arnold. I really loved your paper. I thought the examples were just superb, and I found your conclusion very compelling, that if we want to understand the history of record keeping, we need to look at the master-servant relations and understand the record keepers themselves. But although I was totally seduced by this argument, I also wondered whether we needed to challenge it in some ways, and whether that inadvertently leads us back to a story of intentionality and leads us away from a story of reception, whether we need to think more about audiences and appropriations, and whether also it kind of lures us into that place, which is, I confess, quite hard to escape within this within the remit of this conference, but that kind of literate male club, and whether these might be some of the kind of problems with your conclusion.
You're quite right that what I was trying to challenge really is any idea of a kind of clear trying to see the seeds of a kind of modern bureaucratic archive in the early modern period. I'm not convinced you can do that. I think the archival revolution of the 19th century is so great that it marks quite a clear turning point. And rather than asking if we can see the seeds of the modern archive in the early modern period, we need to turn it around and say, well, why did early modern archival practices survive for so long? They were highly effective. They were highly tenacious. They were highly conservative. So that's really what I'm arguing, trying to turn that kind of narrative progression on its head. You make a point about trying to get away from a kind of male narrative of men and their male secretaries, that's a point well taken. I think I suggested in my paper that you do need to unpick the idea of the secretary that the secretaries themselves give us, the secretary was not the confidant at his master's shoulder. He could also be the clerk and the scrivener and of a lower class. Of course, there were many cases of male secretaries serving female f- f- female employers, and that's a whole story in itself, and could make a paper in itself, and the same kind of anxieties that hang around the idea of the male secretary and the male employer in the closet together also hang around the idea of the male secretary and the female mistress in the closet together. Of course, the famous example, of course, is Mary Queen of Scots and her secretary Rizzio, who is famously murdered in front of her, and a similar case with Elizabeth of Bohemia, where her husband, the elected Palatine, gets very uncomfortable about the fact that her secretary has living quarters so close to the female members of the household. And says, "Well, you know, can't you move him a bit further away?" So I think it isn't simply a question of male relations; it's a question of male female relations as well.
I have a question for both of the speakers, but it comes from, I thought, the quite striking mention in Arnold's paper about secretary as a term being related to secrets. And I wondered if you wanted to talk a bit more about the theme that emerged in the previous panel about sort of record keeping as a form of exclusion and controlling knowledge, and how you derive power from kind of keeping people out of knowledge as well as bringing it in. So both the role that secretaries might play in that, but also for Adam about sort of texts keeping secrets maybe, and how that fits into these issues of genre.
Does it do anything at all? Yes, it does. Okay. Texts that keep secrets. I mean, I guess that the kind of model of textual production that I'm describing here, whereby an early staccato note is revised into a slightly fuller narrative and is revised across a number of books until it reaches a polished kind of coherence, that would fit nicely with that idea of needing to conceal drafts and concealing earlier accounts and producing a kind of carefully controlled final text. I think that's right. And if the model for that process is financial account books, as I think it probably is, that great sudden surge in printed guides to financial accounting talk quite a lot about which books can be publicly legible and viewable and which can't, and are careful to maintain the secrecy of those early drafts and those earlier notes, while the final kind of ordered, ultimately kind of double entry account is kind of viewable to a public to make a particular case.
Yes, well, secrecy is deeply written into the early modern archive, and it's not just a question of secrecy, it's that there are kind of nested Chinese boxes of secrecy, if you like. When Faunce and Beale describe the workings of the principal secretary's office, they describe a system where the second under secretary will have access to the ordinary papers, the other under secretary will have access to the secret papers, and then there'll be a further secret cabinet which only the master has the key. So there are different levels of secrecy within the archive, and those levels of secrecy impose themselves on the physical structure of the archive. One reason for the concern about secrecy is so that documents can be easily destroyed. Beale talks about the reason why Walsingham's papers were such a mess. He said Walsingham made the mistake of keeping his private papers and his public papers together, and so when he died, there was no way of keeping separating the really secret stuff. Whereas if you keep it all in secret cabinet. It's nice and easy. If you get in trouble or if you die suddenly, you can just burn the contents of the cabinet.
Also, just as a tiny little PS to that, if there's some kind of connection between literariness and secrecy, literariness and texts that withhold something, and then it's a critical kind of platitude or truism about Shakespeare that, you know, when he hits his kind of mid-career stride, what happens to his writing is he starts cutting things out, motive, dialogue, things become less clear and less harder to comprehend. So that seems to maybe be an interesting connection there.
I have the microphone. Are you happy for me to use it? Okay, I will use it. So throughout the day, I have been increasingly wondering about, and it keeps coming up as a theme, about how people who are not writing the records or not asking for the records to be written are perceiving them. What is the sort of social currency of archives or sets of records, however we want to define them? As Jake was speaking, he was showing us the rich tradition of Dutch paintings. We've seen lots of paintings today with bits of paper. It turns out that Eric actually knows lots and lots about this. And I was then going to ask a question about what we can get out of either visual or literary evidence about writing of this sort. This is a question for both of you. But I was prompted to think about it by all of that and by the fact that I almost called my paper, and I have a different version of it that I call, and the doctor noted her words, which is how, I'm coming back to Shakespeare, you see, how Simon Forman concludes his account of Macbeth. Because he summarizes the whole mess of what happens in Macbeth with, and the doctor noted her words. I have no idea if that is how the doctor was depicted on stage in the performance that Forman did or did not see. So it's prompted me to wonder whether there is a currency and in any bits of the world that we have heard about today or will hear about tomorrow, where the writing of the record, I mean, you think about the parish register or the court record, is that a scary thing or is that just a normal thing? And we have to desensitize, I mean, I think this is the message of much of what's being said, we have to desensitize ourselves to our sense that we all have a pen in our hands. So can you reflect a bit on how you get outside of your stories and say more about that?
I was thinking about Forman as I was talking, because he sees Macbeth, obviously, but he also sees, he sees Cymbeline as well. 16 writes that kind of comical summer, or incredibly plot-centric summer that just tails off into etc. Roundabout Act 4. So your question, I think there were lots of questions there. One was about kind of visual or literary evidence of writing and how we respond to a Shakespearean depiction of record-keeping or a portrait of a merchant in record-keeping and what we do with that, right? Is that part of what you're asking? I guess, on one level, I'm kind of resistant to kind of privileging Shakespeare, despite the kind of shape of my paper, and he's just a writer surrounded by all this kind of textual traffic and parish records and that kind of notebook culture and that's been well described. And so he's kind of registering that in a sort of helpfully kind of documentary way. But maybe what distinguishes a literary writer like Shakespeare from certain other kinds of sources is that he's interested in, I don't know, identifying problems or tensions or moments of irresolution or difficulty in an act like record keeping. And that's why I think that kind of Giacomo scene in Act 2, Scene 2 is so interesting. And it's not just an act of record keeping and an inventory being linked with truth, but the more you read it, the more fraught and complicated and self-conflicted that becomes as an act. So perhaps portraits and literary texts, if we can use that category, and certainly not documentary sources we turn to for the history of seeing record keeping in practice, but they tell us something about how record keeping was read or understood and how it was seen as problematic or tricky in certain kinds of ways. That too long?
No, that's perfect then.
Okay.
I know there are more questions to come, but I think we should draw to a close there. So before we thank the speakers formally for two really, really rich papers and really good discussion afterwards, I just wanted to point out that's the end of the full day for today, but there is obviously this public panel discussion happening in this room starting at 6 o'clock, so in 40 minutes or so, to which you're very, very welcome to come, and we have a panel so that's to return to the room. You're all very welcome to come back at 6 o'clock. Is that right, Alex? Reception at 7:30, absolutely. But before we adjourn for that, can we please thank Arnold?